This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a special in-depth examination of the background of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Why? Because this could be the most powerful woman in the world if she is elected President of the United States. That is not a problem. If she had impeccable character, high moral and spiritual values, and represented the interest of the majority of Americans, irrespective of their economic, educational, cultural, ethnic backgrounds. Here is the dilemma. The dilemma is that her husband is extremely flawed, not merely being a pathological liar, but also a pathological womanizer. If the public is now made aware of the sexual exploits of women by Bill Cosby, should it not also be equal to criticizing the actions of the former president and when he was governor and attorney general of Arkansas for far more incursions into infidelity than Bill Cosby? Both represented intrusions upon a woman's right to select their own sexual partners and be consensual in that relationship. What a person's sex life is of no interest to me, providing that it's among consenting adults. However, there have been multiple allegations by women coming forward with substantial documentation that it was not consensual and that they were threatened. This was known to everyone around Bill Clinton, including his wife. There have been so many inconsistencies in what she says versus the historical record. My concern is that it's not Hillary Clinton that you would be voting for. Rather, it is an entire stay-behind group of technocrats, bureaucrats, and supporting oligarchs, people in power, people who I've met. In fact, one of my close friends had one of the most important initial fundraisers for the Clintons when he was running for president. My friends are important Democrats, corporate liberals. These are people who are extremely successful in business, as they deserve to be, but they are not the type of Democrat that considers the interests of the poor or the working class, nor are they particularly concerned about the ethics of how they make their money. And when I was speaking to them about why I did not feel comfortable going to a fundraiser for Bill Clinton because I'd researched his background while he was governor of Arkansas and saw massive problems there with the gun running for the Contras, of the drugs coming into the United States, guns going back to the Contras in Nicaragua, and also the support for the illicit drug trafficking, including Barry Seals. More than any other person in American history, Barry Seals, from 1981 to 1985, brought in about $5 billion worth of cocaine himself into the United States. And for the last part of that, he did it with full cooperation under the Bush administration and the National Security Agency, but also completely complicit where certain authorities in the state of Arkansas. And I said, do you realize what you're opening the door to? And the response was startling, so startling that it ended my friendship with this particular couple. And the statement was, well, it's certainly going to be a pretty good deal for all of us who are in business and who will be aligning with him. And I said, but what about his background? That is indifferent, they said. Well, for me, it's not indifferent. Keep in mind, there are tens of thousands of individuals in the United States who will support the Clintons, not because they are the best qualified, the most ethical, the most brilliant at dealing with domestic and foreign policies, the least likely to commit troops into foreign countries, the most progressive when it comes to helping the needs of Americans, to rebuilding our infrastructure, to demilitarization of the police, to reenactment of our civil liberties and the taking down of the National Defense Authorization Act and the Patriot Act and America becoming a totalitarian police state, to hold those responsible in the business and white-collar community for crimes and misdemeanors, and so that there is no longer any right to get out of jail because you're too big to jail and too big to fail. To the contrary, they have shown repeatedly by their associations, their endorsements, the laws that they have passed, or what they have repealed, like the Glass-Steagall Act and the Commodities Future Trading Act, that they are completely complicit. The Clintons personally are in the 1/100th percent, 1/100th of 1% in wealth and power. Their friends and associates treat them as royalty. They don't stay in hotels. They stay in presidential suites. They travel in entourages. They must have private jets. They command hundreds of thousands of dollars for lectures that interest no one. These are paybacks. This is the quid pro quo, a legal form of bribery, where when you do favors for people on Wall Street, they pay it back later. These are people who have supported the Trans-Pacific Partnership. In fact, on 54 separate occasions, as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton met with leaders of foreign countries and promoted America's cooperation in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, knowing full well that this would have dire consequences to the union movement in America, to American labor, and would cause millions of jobs to be outsourced to other countries. But her interest was in maintaining cooperation and hence financial support from these countries and companies. As a result, the Clinton Foundation has received hundreds of millions of dollars in contributions, and almost always the contribution is from some organization, individual, or country that benefits at some political level from either during the Clinton years, after the president left, he then saw those people that supported him, he supported, they in turn supported the foundation, or when she was Secretary of State, and now when she could become president. Now, I will not share everything. It is not possible in this 1 hour. But I will share some key insights that should give us at least reason to pause and ask, do we want this? For example, this is from Juanita Broderick. This is an open letter to Hillary Rodham Clinton from her. Quote, I remember it as though it was yesterday. I only wish that it were yesterday, and maybe there would still be time to do something about what your husband Bill Clinton did to me. There was a political rally for Mr. Clinton's bid for governor of Arkansas, and I have obligated myself to be at this rally prior to my being assaulted by your husband in April of 1978. I made up my mind to make an appearance and then leave as soon as the two of you arrived. This was a big mistake, but I was still in a state of shock and denial. As soon as you entered the room, you came directly to me, grabbed my hand. Do you remember how you thanked me, saying, quote, we want to thank you for everything that you do for Bill. At that point, I was pretty shaken and started to walk off. Remember how you kept a tight grip on my hand and drew me close to you? You repeated your statement, but this time with a coldness and look that I have seen many times on television in the last 8 years. You said, quote, everything you do for Bill. You then released your grip, and I said nothing and left the gathering. What did you mean, Hillary? Were you referring to my keeping quiet about the assault I had suffered at the hands of your husband only 2 weeks before? Were you warning me to continue to keep quiet? We both know the answer to that question. From Marie Dowd, The New York Times, quote, 1999, there's something so rootless and chaotic about the Clintons. They seem like a virus or alien that needs a host body to survive. They've invaded our national psyche, and we're going to have to keep living with their weird marital problems and tangle ambitions forever and ever. Their business will never be finished. They are never going to go away because they have not any place to go. And so it is. And by the way, this is the same Hillary Clinton that told New Zealand television that she had been named after Sir Edmund Hillary. Sir Edmund, however, was an unknown beekeeper the year of Mrs. Clinton's birth. But there are hundreds of inconsistencies. And also, why are we not shown that she lobbied on behalf of the Contras and against those who opposed them in the 1980s? But it is the fact. I'm going to share now some things that people are not aware of. For example, the most liberals believe that Hillary Clinton is a good liberal Democrat. Well, what kind of liberal Democrat would belong to a group called the Fellowship, a secret right-wing religious group involving a number of Washington big names like herself? Quote, the story has been well documented by such publications as Harper's, the Los Angeles Times, and Mother Jones. And it's not a new tale, but it's one the Washington media runs away from, in part because it might wreck the journal's comfortable, servile relationship with some of their sources, with the Clintons near the top of the list. It's Washington's journalism at its worst, the sort of politician pet relationships that led the media to so badly mislead the public about the Iraq War, and for that matter, many other crucial facts about the Clintons. To this day, for example, the media is tough on Barack Obama's Tony Resco relationship, but doesn't mention Hillary Clinton's much deeper relationship with Webster Hubbell. As it was noted, the two exceptions to the media cover-up of the Fellowship are Andrea Mitchell and Jim Popkin of NBC, who reported, quote, in his preaching, Fellowship leader Douglas Coe repeatedly urges a personal commitment to Jesus Christ. It's a commitment Coe compares to a blind devotion to Adolf Hitler demanded from his followers, a rhetorical technique that now is drawing sharp criticism. Hitler, Goebbels, Himmler were three men. Think of the immense power these three men had. These nobodies from nowhere, Coe said. Later in the sermon, Coe said, quote, Jesus said, you have to put me before other people, and you have to put me before yourself. Hitler, that was the demand to be in the Nazi Party. You had to put the Nazi Party and its objectives ahead of your own life and ahead of other people. Coe also quotes Jesus and said, quote, one of the things Jesus said is, if any man comes to me and does not hate his father, mother, brother, sister, his own life, he can't be a disciple. So I don't care what other qualifications you have. If you don't do that, you can't be a disciple of Christ. The sermons are a little surprise to writer Jeff Sherritt. He lived among Coe's followers 6 years ago and came out troubled by their secrecy and rhetoric. Quote, we were being taught the leadership lessons of Hitler, Lenin, Mao, and I would say, there isn't a problem with that. And they seem perplexed by the question. Hitler's genocide wasn't really an issue for them. It was the strength that he emulated. They're notoriously secretive, Charlotte said. In fact, they jokingly call themselves the Christian Mafia, which becomes less of a joke when you realize that they really are dedicated to being what they call an invisible organization. Source washed, quote, the Fellowship headquartered in Washington, D.C. is the humanitarian religious right Christian organization about which very little is known. Their signature event is the annual national prayer breakfast, but that is only a small part of their activities. They're heavily involved in the political culture of Washington, counting at least a dozen senators and congressmen as members. The group also has gone by the names Family, Foundation, C Street Center, and International Christian Leadership. An article published in March 2003 issue of Harper's entitled Jesus Plus Nothing by Jeffrey Charlotte provides an excellent exposition. However, Charlotte's infiltrated only at the lowest level, and so his article is woefully short of details concerning the organization, its mission, or who runs it. And so it goes. Well, Clinton is a part of that. And according to Mother Jones, through all her years in Washington, Clinton has been an active participant in conservative Bible study and prayer circles that are part of a secretive Capitol Hill group known as the Fellowship. And her collaborations with right-wingers such as Senator Sam Brownback, a Republican of Kansas, and former Senator Rick Santorum, grow in part from that connection. When Clinton first came to Washington in 1993, one of her first steps was to join the Bible study group. For the next 8 years, she regularly met with a Christian cell, whose members included Susan Baker, wife of Bush's James Baker, friend, and Joanna Kemp, wife of conservative icon Jack Kemp, and others. Clinton's prayer group was part of the Fellowship, a network of sex-segregated cells of political, business, and military leaders dedicated to spiritual war on behalf of Christ, many of them recruited at the Fellowship's only public event, the annual National Prayer Breakfast. And the Fellowship's ideals are essentially a blend of Calvinism and Norman Vincent Peale. And so the question is, why is this not discussed? It's perfectly acceptable for a person to have any religious views and any connections they choose. But why not bring it into the open so it can be discussed? What I'm going to do now for the remainder of this program is share a part of Hillary and Bill Clinton's past that you're not aware of. And keep in mind, much of it is about Bill Clinton and his associates. Virtually all of these associates, virtually all the banks, all the organizations that I'm going to mention were later involved in problems. Most went bankrupt or were found guilty of committing crimes. Almost all the people ended up either dead or convicted of crimes, but they were all in the inner circle of the Clintons. And Bill Clinton did nothing without the overarching empowerment of Hillary Clinton. She was aware of everything. I want to share the following, and we want to thank Sam Smith for an enormous amount of the research. Let us begin in 1974. 27-year-old Clinton, only months out of Yale Law School, was back in Arkansas, eager to run for Congress. Roger Morris writes later, quote, a relative unknown, he faces an imposing field of rivals in the Democratic primary and beyond. In the general election, a powerful Republican incumbent. Yet as soon as he enters the race, Mr. Clinton enjoys a decisive 7-to-1 advantage in campaign funds over the nearest Democratic competitor and will spend twice as much as his well-supported GOP opponent. It begins with a quiet meeting at his mother's house in Hot Springs. Around the kitchen table, as Virginia Clinton will describe the scene, avid young Billy meets with two of his most crucial early backers, Uncle Raymond G. Clinton, a prosperous local Buick dealer, and family friend and wealthy businessman Gabe Crawford. As they talk, Mr. Crawford offers the candidate unlimited use of his private plane, and Uncle Raymond not only provides several houses around the direct district to serve as campaign headquarters, but will secure a $10,000 loan to Bill from the First National Bank of Hot Springs, an amount then equal to the yearly income of many Arkansas families. Together, the money and aircraft and other gifts, including thousands of dollars in secret donations, will launch Mr. Clinton in the most richly financed race in the annals of Arkansas, and ultimately onto the most richly financed political career in American history. And though he loses narrowly, his showing is so impressive, especially in his capacity to attract such money and favors, that he rises rapidly to become state attorney general, then governor, and eventually, with much the same backing and advantage, president of the United States. No mere businessman with a spare plane, Gabe Crawford presided over a backroom bookie operation that was one of Hot Springs' most lucrative criminal enterprises. And the Uncle Raymond, who had also played a pivotal behind-the-scenes role in keeping young Bill out of the Vietnam draft, was far more than an auto dealer. In the nationally prominent font of vice and corruption that was Hot Springs from the 1920s to the 1980s, it barely concealed casinos generated more income than Las Vegas well into the 1960s. The uncle's Buick agency and other businesses and real estate were widely thought to be facades for illegal gambling, drug money laundering, and other ventures, in which Raymond was a partner. He was a minion of the organized crime overlord who controlled the American Middle South for decades, New Orleans' boss, Carlos Marcello, or Mafia Kingfish, as his biographer John Davis called him. Bill Clinton is elected Attorney General of Arkansas. Now, 1977, Hillary joins the Rose Laws firm. Apparently because of pressure from Indonesia, people who have been big supporters, two Indonesian billionaires, come to Arkansas. A man named Wrighty and another man, Layong, are close to Suharto, and they're looking to buy an American bank. And they find Jackson Stevens, with whom he formed Stevens Finance. Stevens will broker the arrival of BCCI, one of the most corrupt banks in American history, into this country and steer BCCI's founder, Hassan Abadi, to Burt Lance. And Wrighty's teenage son is taken on as an intern by Stevens. He later says he was sponsored by Bill Clinton. Wrighty withdraws his bid to buy Lance's 30% share of the National Bank of Georgia. Instead, a BCCI frontman buys the shares, and Abadi moves to secretly take over Financial General, later First American Bank shares. In 1978, Clinton is elected governor. The Clintons and McDougals buy land in the Ozarks for $203,000 with mostly borrowed funds. The Clintons get 50% interest in the deal with no cash down. The 203-acre plot, known as Whitewater, is 50 miles from the nearest grocery store. The Washington Post will report later that some purchasers of lots, many of them retirees, quote, more than half of the purchasers will lose their plots thanks to the sleazy form of the financing used. 2 months after commencing the Whitewater scam, Hillary Clinton invests $1,000 in cattle futures. Within a few days, she has a $5,000 profit. Before bailing out, she earns nearly $100,000 on a $1,000 investment. Many years later, several economists will calculate that the chances of her earning those returns legally were 1 in 250 million. Governor Clinton appoints Jim McDougal his partner in that deal, an economic development advisor. Bill Clinton's mother hangs out at the racetrack with mobsters and other local figures, including Dan Lassiter, who breeds racehorses in Kentucky and Florida and has a box at the track next to hers. Mrs. Clinton introduces Lassiter to Roger Clinton. Roger Clinton, Bill's brother, develops a 4-gram-a-day cocaine habit, getting his stuff from New York and Medellin and Columbia suppliers, and based upon his one middleman will later testify under oath, quote, on who his brother was, meaning Bill Clinton was the governor. Charlene Wilson is one of his dealers. Dan Lassiter will give Roger work and loan him $8,000 to pay off his drug debt. Juanita Broderick, a volunteer in Clinton's gubernatorial campaign, will later claim she was attacked by Clinton and her lip almost bitten off. According to Roger Morris and Partners in Power, a young woman lawyer in Little Rock will later claim that she was accosted by Bill Clinton this year, and that when she recoiled he forced himself on her, biting her and bruising her. Quote, deeply affected by the assault, the woman decided to keep it all quiet for the sake of her own hard-won career and that of her husband. 1979, Charlene Wilson will testify in a 1990 federal grand jury probe that she began selling cocaine to Roger Clinton as early as 1979. She'll also tell reporters that she sold 2 grams of cocaine to Clinton's brother at the Little Rock nightclub, La Bistro, then witnessed Bill Clinton consume the drug. Quote, I watched Bill Clinton lean up against a brick wall, Wilson reveals to the London Telegraph's Ambrose Evans Pritchard in 1995. Quote, he was so messed up that night, he slid down the wall into a garbage can and just sat there like a complete idiot. Wilson also described gatherings at Little Rock's Coachman's Inn between 1979 and 1981, where she saw Clinton using cocaine, quote, quite avidly with friends. Drug prosecutor Gene Duffy will say that she had no doubt that Wilson was telling the truth. The Clintons and McDougals form Whitewater Development Company. Now keep in mind, the drugs that a person takes are their business. I actually believe that drugs should be made legal. I believe that everyone in prison for nonviolent crimes using drugs, possession of drugs, or dealing in drugs should be let out. If they have a problem, it shouldn't be treated as a, let's say, criminal offense. It should be treated as a psychological or medical issue and helped and hence rehabilitated within a society by having clinics, drug rehab clinics, in every part of the United States, because we have drug problems in every single part of the United States. So the person using a drug, whether it was George Bush who used it and or Barack Obama used it or Bill Clinton who used it, that is not the issue. My concern is that it was under Bill Clinton that some of the most draconian drug laws were put into place. So that right now, as we speak, there are people by the hundreds of thousands in prison because a Bill Clinton putting these laws into place. Well, how is it that he has never come forward and said that the laws that I helped enact that caused people to be in prison for decades or long periods of time and the destruction of their family and their reputations and their future earning capacity, these were wrong. These were political. These were to appease the right. But he hasn't done that. And as a result, I think it is only proper to show the hypocrisy of a person who was such a heavy user and where his state had more drugs coming in than even Florida. In the 1980s, Governor Clinton appoints Webb Hubbell to head a new state ethics commission. This is the same Hubbell that will later go to prison. First tasked to weaken the ethics legislation currently under consideration by exempting the governor from some of its most rigorous provisions. Arkansas becomes a major center for gun running, drugs, and money laundering. The IRS even warns other law enforcement agencies of the state's enticing climate, they say. According to Clinton biographer Roger Morris, operatives go into banks with duffel bags full with cash, which bank officers then distribute to tellers in sums under $10,000 so they don't have to report the transaction. Charlene Wilson, according to investigative reporter Ambrose Evans Pritchard, flies cocaine from Arkansas to a pickup point in Texas. Other drugs, she says, are stuffed into chickens for shipping around the country, and Wilson also serves as, quote, as the lady with the snow at toga parties attended, she reports, by Bill Clinton. According to Wilson, quote, I lived in Little Rock, Arkansas, okay, and I worked at a club called Le Bistro, and I met Roger Clinton there, Governor Clinton, Bill Clinton, a couple of his state troopers that went with him wherever he went. Roger Clinton had come to me, and he asked me, could I give him some coke, you know, and ask for my one-hitter, which a one-hitter is a very small silver device that you stick up your nose, and you just squeeze it, and a snort of cocaine will go up there. And I watched Roger hand what I had given him to Governor Clinton, and he just kind of turned and walked off. End quote. Investors Business Daily would write later, quote, Sally Perdue, a former Miss Arkansas and Little Rock talk show host who said she had an affair with then Governor Clinton in 1983, told the London Sunday Telegraph that he came over to her house with a bag full of cocaine, quote, he had all the equipment laid out like a real pro. In the 1990s, Jennifer Flowers tells WABC radio show, quote, he smoked marijuana in my presence, and he offered me the opportunity to snort cocaine if I wanted it. It wasn't into me to do that. Bill clearly let me know that he did cocaine, and I know people that knew he did cocaine. He did tell me that when he would use a substantial amount of cocaine, his head would itch so badly that he would become self-conscious at parties where he was doing this, because all he wanted to do while people were talking to him was stand around and scratch his head. Two Arkansas state troopers will swear under oath that they have seen Clinton, quote, under the influence of drugs when he was governor. Charlene Wilson is a bartender who ended up serving time on drug crimes and cooperating with drug investigators. She told a federal grand jury she saw Clinton and his younger brother, quote, snort cocaine together in 1979. Jack McCoy, a Democratic state representative and Clinton supporter, told the Sunday Telegraph that he could, quote, remember going into the governor's conference room once and it reeked of marijuana. Historian Roger Morris, in his book Partners in Power, quotes several law enforcement officials who say they had seen and knew of Clinton's drug use. One-time apartment manager Jane Parks claims that in 1984 she could listen through the wall as Bill and Roger Clinton, in a room adjoining hers, discussed the quality of the drugs they were taking. Hillary Clinton makes a $44,000 profit on a $2,000 investment in a cell phone franchise deal that involves taking advantage of the FCC's preferences for locals, minorities, and women. The franchise is almost immediately flipped to the cellular giant Macau. A drug pilot brings a Cessna 210 full of cocaine into eastern Arkansas, where he is met by a pickup truck, a state trooper in a marked car, police car. Arkansas, the pilot would later recall years later, quote, was a very good place to load and unload. Then we have Vince Foster. According to his wife, security operative Jerry Parks delivers large sums of money from MENA Airport to Vince Foster at a Kmart parking lot. Mrs. Parks discovers this when she opens her car trunk one day and finds so much cash that she has to sit on the trunk to close it again. She asks her husband whether he's dealing drugs, and he allegedly explains that Foster paid him $1,000 for each trip he took to Mena. Parks said he didn't know what they were doing, and he didn't care to know. He told me to forget about what I had seen. Later, Evans Pritchards will write, quote, Foster was using him as a kind of operative to collect sensitive information on things to do in sensitive jobs. Some of this appears to have been done on behalf of Hillary Clinton. Foster told him that Hillary wanted it done. Now, my understanding is that she wanted to know how vulnerable Bill Clinton was in a presidential race on the question of his appetites. Hillary Clinton quietly lobbies on behalf of the Contras and against groups and individuals opposing the Contras. Keep in mind, the Contras were terrorists. They were killers. These were people who were involved up to their eyeballs in drugs and arms. And these were the people who had been part of Somoza's National Guard, and he was one of the most brutal, dictatorial, oppressive persons in all of Nicaragua's history. And his National Guard kept total control over the population, all of his politics, and all of his economics. Every major dealership, whether it was a car dealership or a store, his family had an interest in. Corrupt from top to bottom. So those are the people that would later become the Contras. And Ronald Reagan would state that these were like our founding fathers. Why, I hardly think that anyone who knows anything about our history would equate drug runners and the people who are complete terrorists and criminals with our founding fathers. And Dan Lassiter's parties become known around Little Rock for the availability of cocaine and women. And a model named Judy, who was also a call girl, runs a powerful house of prostitution in Fordsey with her sister. They also blackmail some of their more powerful clients. And both her family and one of the Clinton bodyguards will later link Judy to the governor. She decides to cooperate with police in an investigation of Arkansas cocaine trafficking, but is burned to death inside her home from a fire of undetermined origin. In 1999, in a report in Newsmax, quote, former Clinton bodyguard Barry Spivey had become something of a mystery man who insisted on meeting Paula Jones investigator Rick Lambert on a deserted road nestled deep in the Arkansas backwoods. The Jones investigator admitted he was none too comfortable with the situation. Spivey shared a story about a conversation he had with Bill Clinton while on a flight over southern Arkansas. The trooper noticed a blackened patch amidst the greenery below that, surprisingly, Clinton recognized. That patch was all that was left of an estate that had burned to the ground in the mid-1980s. According to the trooper, Clinton began reminiscing about rumors of his involvement with the woman of the house, at one time penthouse pet. Her husband, Spivey said, was involved in a pornography ring. Clinton explained to Spivey, you know that mansion just burned down right on top of them. Years later, Spivey remained struck by one thing, the eerie expression that crossed Clinton's face as he spoke those words. 1980, Bill Clinton loses re-election as governor. He will win 2 years later. Larry Nichols will tell the George Putman Show in 1998 that he had met with Clinton and Jackson Stevens' brother, Whit, and that Whit had told Clinton that Stevens, by the way, Stevens is one of the most powerful, wealthy people in all of Arkansas, were ready to back him for another run at the governorship, but they had to, quote, had to have him dry out on the white stuff. There are reports that followed his loss. Clinton ended up in the hospital for a drug overdose. Journalist R. Emmett Tyrrell later asked emergency room workers at the University of Arkansas Medical Center if they could confirm the incident. He didn't get a flat no from the hospital staff. One nurse said, quote, I can't talk about it. Another said she feared for her life if she spoke of the matter. A report that, quote, Dr. Sam Houston, a respected Little Rock physician and once a doctor for Hillary's cantankerous father, Hugh Rodham Clinton, says it is, or Hugh Rodham says it is well known in Little Rock medical circles that Clinton was brought to a Little Rock hospital for emergency treatment for an apparent cocaine overdose. According to Houston, who told us he spoke to someone intimately familiar with the details of what happened that night, Clinton arrived at the hospital with the aid of a state trooper. Hiller Clinton had been notified by phone and instructed the hospital staff that Clinton's personal physician would be arriving soon. When Mrs. Clinton arrived, she told both the resident physicians on duty that night that they would never practice medicine in the United States if word leaked out about Clinton's drug problem. According to Jim McDougall's later account, he and Henry Hamilton developed a system to pass money to Clinton, then governor of Arkansas. Quote, "I consider it just another way of helping take care of Bill. A contractor agreed to pad my monthly subcontracting bill by $2,000. The contractor put the figure on his invoice as a cost for gravel or culvert work. After I paid the full amount, the contractor reimbursed me the $2,000. I turned the money over to Henry to give to Clinton. Once, after I handed Henry his latest consignment of $100 bills to relay to the governor's office, he turned the bills over and over in one hand like a magician. Henry grinned. Quote, "You know, Caesar had his Brutus, Charles I had Cromwell. Clinton could profit from these examples if he crosses us." 1981. Hillary Clinton writes Jim McDougall, "If Reaganomics works at all, Whitewater can become the Western Hemisphere's Mecca." Major drug trafficker Barry Seal, under pressure from the Louisiana cops, relocates his operations to Mena, Arkansas. Seal's importing as much as 1,000 pounds of cocaine a month from Columbia, according to Arkansas law enforcement officials. He will claim to have made more than $50 million out of that operation. As an informant, Seal testified that in 1980-81, before moving his operation to Arkansas, he made approximately 60 trips to Central America and brought back 18,000 kilograms. In 1996, the Progressive Review will report, quote, "The London Telegraph has obtained some of the first depositions in ex-CIA contractor flyer Terry Reed's suit against Clinton's ex-security chief and now high-paid FEMA director Buddy Young. According to the Telegraph's Ambrose Evans Pritchard, Larry Patterson, an Arkansas state trooper, testified under oath that there were large quantities of drugs being flown in the Mena, Arkansas airport, large quantities of money, large quantities of guns. The subject was discussed repeatedly in Clinton's presence by state troopers working on his security detail." And Roger Morris and Sally Denton said, "Seal's legacy includes more than 2,000 newly discovered documents that now verify and quantify much of what previously had been only suspicion, conjecture, or legend. The documents confirm that from 1981 until his brutal death in 1986, Barry Seal carried on one of the most lucrative, extensive, and brazen operations in the history of the international drug trade, and that he did it with the evident complicity, if not collusion, of elements of the U.S. government, apparently with the acquiescence of Ronald Reagan's administration, impunity from any subsequent exposure by George Bush's administration, and under the usually acute political nose of then-Arkansas Bill Clinton." Mena state troopers, including Russell Welch, will later describe the airport, pointing to one hangar he says is owned by a man who, quote, "doesn't exist in history back past a safe house in Baltimore in 1972. Another is owned by someone who smuggled heroin through Laos back in the 70s. Still another is owned by a guy who just went bankrupt. So what he does, he flies to Europe for more money." In 1982, the DEA report undercovered by Ambrose Evans Pritchard will cite an informant claiming that a key Arkansas figure and backer of Clinton smuggles cocaine from Columbia, South America, inside racehorses to Hot Springs. The London Telegraph writes, quote, "Basil Abbott, a convicted drug pilot, says that he flew a Cessna 210 full of cocaine into Marianna in eastern Arkansas in the spring of 1982. The aircraft was welcomed by an Arkansas state trooper in a marked police car. IRS agent William Duncan and an Arkansas state police investigator take their evidence concerning drug trafficking in Mena to U.S. Attorney Asa Hutchinson. They ask for 20 witnesses to be subpoenaed before the grand jury. Hutchinson chooses only three." Now here's where it gets interesting. Here's where, once you're connected to the inner circle of the Clintons, you have a real hard time making anything stick. According to reporter Mara Leverett, quote, the three appeared before the grand jury, but afterwards two of them also expressed surprise at how their questioning was handled. One, a secretary at Rich Mountain Aviation, had given Duncan, remember Duncan is the IRS agent, sworn statements about money laundering at the company, transcripts of which Duncan had provided to Hutchinson. But when the woman left the jury room, she complained that Hutchinson had asked her nothing about the crime or the sworn statements she had given to Duncan. As Duncan later testified, quote, she basically said that all she was allowed to give was her name, address, position, and not much else. The other angry witness was a banker who had, in Duncan's word, quote, provided a significant amount of evidence relating to the money laundering operation. According to Duncan, he too emerged from the jury room complaining, quote, that he was not allowed to provide the evidence that he wanted to provide to the grand jury. Hence, nothing happened. And you see this repeatedly when it comes to the Clintons. Substantial evidence from witnesses, but the witnesses' evidence is not considered. Roger Morse and Sally Denton, in an article, according to the IRS criminal investigator Duncan, secretaries at the Mena, Arkansas airport told him that when Seal flew into Mena, quote, there would be stacks of cash to be taken to the bank and laundered. One secretary told him that she was ordered to obtain numerous cashier's checks, each in the amount just under $10,000, at various banks in Mena and surrounding communities to avoid filing the federal currency transactions reports required by all banks that exceed the limit. Bank tellers testified before a federal grand jury that in November 1982, a Mena airport employee carried a suitcase containing $70,000 in cash into the bank. The bank officer went down the teller's lines, handing out the stacks of $1,000 bills and got the cashier's checks. Law enforcement sources confirmed that hundreds of thousands of dollars were laundered in the banks, in just a few small banks in Mena, and that millions more from Seal's operation were laundered elsewhere in Arkansas and the nation. Bill Clinton then wins back the governorship. And in 1983, this is when a lot of the different organizations, banks and finance organizations around Clinton or Clinton operatives, including Jim McDougal, become into form. And state regulators warned Jim McDougal's Madison Guaranteed Savings Loan to stop making imprudent loans. Governor Clinton is also warned of the problem but takes no action. According to a later account in the Tampa Tribune, planes flying drugs into Mena in coolers marked medical supplies are met by several people close to then-Governor Clinton. Although he's under investigation for drug activities, Dan Lassiter's firm is given a piece of 14 state bond issues by the governor. Judge David Hale's Capital Management Services starts making loans to state figures. David Hale is a former Arkansas municipal judge and former Arkansas banker. He worked with Jim McDougal on a $3 million in loans from lending company he ran. He pled guilty and went to jail for conspiring to defraud the Small Business Administration, looting funds from a dummy business established. As part of his guilty plea in looting money from the insurance company, he provided the allegations for the Whitewater scandal and testimony for its investigators. And, in fact, Hale testified in U.S. District Court that Governor Bill Clinton pressured him to make a fraudulent $300,000 loan that he had not, and that he not be named in the loan. 1984, Clinton backers Jack Stevens and Ridey buy a banking firm and change its name to Worthen Bank. And that is to later go broke and cost the people of Arkansas a great deal. Then later, Barry Seals estimates that he's earned over $100 million net smuggling cocaine into the U.S. But with the feds closing in on him, Barry Seal flies from Mena, Arkansas, to Washington, D.C. in a private Learjet to meet with two members of Vice President George Bush's drug task force. Following the meeting, Seal rolls over for the DEA, becoming an informant. He collects information on leaders in the Bedelian cartel while still dealing in drugs himself. The deal will be kept secret from investigators working in Louisiana and Arkansas. And according to reporter Mara Leverett, quote, by Seal's own account, his gross income in the year and a half after he became an informant while he was based in Mena and while Asha Hutchinson was the federal prosecutor in Fort Smith, Arkansas, was $750,000. so reported that $575,000 of that income had been derived from a single cocaine shipment, which the DEA had allowed him to keep. Pressed further, he testifies that since going to work for the DEA, he had imported 1,500 pounds of cocaine in the United States. So why is this important? Because remember later, when Gary Webb would talk about the CIA being involved in getting drugs into Los Angeles, he would be attacked by the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times. He would be denigrated by American media. And yet he was right. He was absolutely correct. And in many conversations I had with Gary Webb, he said that he didn't think for a moment that the mainstream media would turn against him and that they would be so supportive of whatever the official position was coming out of the Justice Department or the White House. So how would it look if Gary Webb was shown not just to be right about Los Angeles, but the DEA was behind thousands of pounds of cocaine coming in to MENA, Arkansas, be diverted and delivered around the United States, and therefore supplying millions of Americans with their cocaine for their habit, at the same time having a war on drugs? It would be a series of contradictions, but that was the truth of it. 1985, Roger Clinton pleads guilty to cocaine distribution, but cops a plea on more serious charges with a promise to cooperate. He'll serve a very short prison term. Mrs. Clinton is put on a $2,000 a month retainer by Madison Guarantee. Again, Jim McDougal. Jim McDougal will later write in his book that the payments were in lieu of his earlier system of passing money to Bill Clinton. Mrs. Clinton will later claim not to have received any retainer, nor to have been deeply involved with Madison Guarantee. Subsequent records show, however, that she represented Madison before the State Securities Department. After the revelation, she says, quote, "For goodness sakes, you can't be a lawyer if you don't represent banks." Bill Clinton established the Arkansas Development Finance Authority that will be used, in the words of one well-connected Arkansan, quote, "as his own personal political piggy bank. Though millions of dollars are funneled to Clinton allies, records of repayments will be hazy or non-existent." And that was just a small part of it. Then also we go to 1986, where journalist Evans Pritchard will describe the Arkansas of this period, quote, "as a major point for the transshipment of drugs and perilously close to becoming a narco-republic, a sort of mini-Colombia within the borders of the United States. There's, quote, "an epidemic of cocaine contaminating the political establishment from top to bottom, with parties at which cocaine would be served like hors d'oeuvres, and sex was rampant." Clinton attended some of these events. According to former CIA official David McMichael and Ray McGovern, who've had on this program many times, and Barry Seal, former TWA pilot who had trained Nicaraguan Contra pilots in the early 80s and who is facing a long sentence after a federal drug conviction in Florida, making his way to the White House's National Security Council to make the following proposition to officials there. He would fly his own plane to Colombia and take delivery of cocaine. He would then make an emergency landing in Nicaragua and make it appear that Sandinista officials were aiding him in drug trafficking. Seal made it clear that he would expect help with his legal problems. The Reagan White House jumps at the offer. Seal's plane is flown to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where it was fitted with secret cameras to enable Seal to photograph Nicaraguan officials in the act of assisting him with a box of cocaine. On January 17th, U.S. Attorney for the Western District drops a money laundering and narcotics conspiracy charges against associates of drug smuggler Barry Seal over the protests of investigators Russell Welch of the State Police and Bill Duncan of the Internal Revenue Service. In a letter to U.S. Attorney General Edmund Meese, the Louisiana Attorney General wrote, "Barry Seal, quote, smuggled between $3 to $5 billion of drugs in the United States," end quote. The operation goes as planned. The photos are delivered to the White House, and a triumphant Ronald Reagan goes on national television to show that the Sandinistas are not only communists, but also criminals intent on addicting American youth. Little did they know it was all a setup. It was all a false flag. But it worked. The operation goes as planned, and a Federal Home Loan Bank Board audit describes Madison as financially reckless, conflicts of interest rampant. Dan Lassiter, Arkansas bond don, who is close to Clinton, pleads guilty to cocaine distribution charges. The case also involves Clinton's stepbrother, Roger, who testifies against Lassiter in a plea agreement. Both Lassiter and Roger Clinton will serve brief prison terms. While Lassiter is in prison, his affairs will be run by Patsy Thomason, who later becomes a White House aide and close confidant of Hillary Clinton. 1987. According to the McDougals, the Whitewater files are transferred to the Clintons. In a 1992 campaign, the Clintons will say they cannot find the records. Clinton gives Arkansas Traveler Awards to Contra operatives Adolfo and Mario Calero and John Singleout. According to Ambrose Evans Pritchard of the London Telegraph, on August 1987, Arkansas Police Lieutenant Russell Welch receives secret teletype from the FBI office in Chicago advising, quote, the CIA and DEA operation is taking place at the MENA airport. I feel like I live in Russia, waiting for the secret police to pounce on me. Two boys, Kevin Ives and Don Henry, are killed in Saline County and left on the railroad track to be run over by a train. The medical examiner will initially rule the deaths accidental, saying that the boys were unconscious and in a deep sleep due to marijuana. The findings will be punctured by dogged investigators whose efforts are repeatedly blocked by law enforcement officials. Ultimately, the bodies will be exhumed and another autopsy will be performed, which finds that Henry had been stabbed in the back and Ives beaten with a rifle butt. Although no one will ever be charged, the trial will lead to the Dixie Mafia and the Arkansas political machine. Some believe the boys died because they accidentally intercepted a drug drop, but other information obtained by the Progressive Review suggests the drop may have dispensed not just drugs but cash, gold, and platinum, part of a series of sorties through which those working with U.S. intelligence are being reimbursed. According to one version, the boys were blamed in order to cover up the theft of the drop by persons with the Dixie Mafia and Arkansas political machine. Ives' mother will later charge that high state and federal officials participated in a cover-up. I firmly believe my son and Don Henry were killed because they witnessed a drug drop by an airplane connected to the MENA drug smuggling routes. Prosecutor Gene Duffy will later tell talk show host in answer to whether law enforcement people were involved in the train deaths murders, quote, I believe the law enforcement agents were connected to some very high political people because they have never been brought to justice, and I don't think they ever will. I think they are protected to avoid exposing the connection. There have been several murders of potential witnesses. Anyone who could have solved this murder many years ago has been systematically eliminated. Nine persons reportedly having information on the Ives-Henry murders will end up dead themselves. Keith McCaskill will express fear for his life because, quote, the railroad track thing and tell his parents goodbye before his murder. An inmate will report being offered $4,000 to kill McCaskill. A suspect in the Ives-Henry murders will die in what initially thought to have been a robbery but turns out to have been a setup. Monty Bergden vanishes without a trace. It is rumored he knows exactly what had happened at the tracks. James Milne is found decapitated. Nonetheless, the state medical examiner, who also called the Ives death accidental, will declare the death to be of natural causes, even though he was decapitated. Jeff Rhodes will be shot, burned, and have his hands and feet partially sawed off. I'm surprised they didn't call that in Arkansas a natural death. And Harkin Energy and George Bush on the board gets rescued by aid from the BCCI Bank. That's again connected. In 1988, conservative Democrats begin a series of nearly 100 meetings held at the home of Pam Harriman to plot strategy for the takeover of the Democratic Party. Donors cough up $1,000 to attend, and Harriman eventually raises $12 million for a kind of Democrat. A right-wing Democrat will eventually settle for Bill Clinton as their presidential choice. Charles Black, a prosecutor for Polk County, which includes MENA, meets with Governor Clinton and asks for assistance in a probe of illegal activities. His response, quote, well, was that he would get a man on it and get back to me. I never heard back. Following pressure from then Arkansas Representative Bill Alexander, General Accounting Office opens a probe into April 1988. Within 4 months, the inquiry is shut down by the National Security Council. According to a later report by Morrison of the Wall Street Journal, several congressional subcommittee inquiries sputter and stop. According to journalist Philip Wise, quote, in 1988, Bill Clinton chose not to run for presidency in part out of fear of personal disclosure about his sex life. The story goes, but it's persuasive that Hillary Clinton was angry that he bowed out and wanted a divorce. She compiled a divorce file with her friend, lawyer Vince Foster, involving a number of women in Arkansas. Ultimately, she dropped the plan. And that is before he becomes president. And then there is a whole lot to say about his being president, and she is as the co-president. Keep in mind that these are a matter of record, the statements I've made. Nothing has been done. Is this the type of person, is this the type of environment that we want running our country? Haven't we had enough of these type of persons? Shouldn't we be looking for people that represent the people and represent the Constitution, represent the Bill of Rights, represents the rule of law, represents the rebuilding of American cities, the deghettoization of our country, helping people who have problems instead of imprisoning them? Isn't it time that we deconstructed the private prison system, that we deconstructed the militarization of the police, that we deconstructed the surveillance state that we have become, that we deconstructed the power of the oligarchs to have their political will done by whoever they pay? I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening.